You might just think of it as a benign green slime that has to be skimmed from a pool, or at worst, the reason you shouldn't eat shellfish during a red tide. But new research has linked algae blooms to the last five mass extinctions, and we'll find out how on today's first underreported segment. Joining us now are Clemson University professors James Castle, a geologist, and John Rogers, director of the university's ecotoxicology program. They're co-authors of a recent program on algae and mass extinctions, and I'm very pleased that they join me now on our show. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
In your paper, you describe cyanobacteria, which is also known as blue-green algae, as a kill mechanism that has contributed directly to mass extinction. John, how could a tiny little organism wipe out most of the planet's species?
Well, it's not our intention to scare people right off the bat, but some of the toxins that these algae produce, as an environmental toxicologist, we study those very carefully. Some of them are as potent as the toxins produced by cobras. And if you remember sarin and some of the incidents with death of people as they were in caught in trains and so on, those toxins are not nearly as potent as the ones produced by some of the cyanobacteria. So as we study these neurotoxins and liver toxins and dermatitis toxins, we realize just how widespread and how potent they are.
Are we talking about the kinds of extinctions that killed off the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous period?
Well, I would certainly defer to my colleague, Jim, but that has been our conclusion to date, yes.
Jim, you want to talk about that? It seems to me if an asteroid struck Earth at the end of the dinosaur's period, wouldn't the reduction in sunlight hinder the kinds of algal blooms that you're talking about?
Well, it could. In some ways, our theory, though, is very consistent with asteroid impact or volcanism, because those may also have contributed to global warming. And in fact, other scientists have seen the evidence, strong evidence for global warming conditions and increased abundance of algae at the end of the Cretaceous.
So we're really relying on the fossil record?
We're relying on the fossil record as it's preserved in the strata. And we're also relying on what we observe today in the modern toxin-producing algae.
So there was an increase in algal, and is it algal or algal?
Algal is probably the more common pronunciation.
There was an increase in algal blooms during these times when there were mass extinctions. Is that solid evidence, or is that the kind of evidence we might call circumstantial?
Well, it's one type of evidence, and that's where we started. We have a lot more to do, of course, but first thing we looked at is the distribution of what we call stromatolites. That's the direct evidence for algal growth in the past through geologic time, and found out that their occurrence abundance increased at four of the five mass extinction events. And for all five mass extinction events, there's been noted that there's evidence for anoxia from decay, that's reduced oxygen in the environment, from a large mass of organic material produced by algal blooms at all of those extinctions. So there's quite a bit of evidence, but still we'd like to get some direct chemical evidence.
John, what do algal blooms do to water?
Well, they can do all sorts of things, from alter sort of fundamental water chemistry to obviously production of toxins. Some of the more common algal blooms that folks may be familiar with are the ones, for example, off the coast of China during the last Olympics, or the so-called dead zone down in the Gulf of Mexico. We see accumulation of organic matter. We see accumulation of these algae. They have they're readily biodegradable, so they consume a lot of oxygen and result in anoxia, or a loss of oxygen from the water column, and the consequent death of fish and other organisms that require oxygen.
Are they dangerous to humans?
Well, certainly they are, and I'm at a meeting for the North American Lake Management Society in Hartford, Connecticut today, And today we're talking about some of the neurodegenerative diseases such as ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. I met with a neurotoxicologist this morning, and we had a nice discussion on the patterns of that neurodegenerative disease as it seems to be growing in the Northeast, particularly. This happened to be a toxicologist from New Hampshire, and he's studying the incidence of the disease for people that live near lakes with cyanobacterial blooms, as well as wells, drink from wells and shallow wells that are adjacent to those lakes. So he's discovered that some of these toxins can move in well water, which is most concerning.
What about, other than the well water, would the toxins have to work their way up the food chain to affect humans?
Well, they certainly could, and there are records of that, actually. There are islands where people eat animals that consume plants that have picked up these algae, that grow these algae in a symbiotic relationship, and thereby they concentrate the toxin, they bioconcentrate or biomagnify the toxin, and it's accumulated to much higher levels. And then finally, people eat the mammals that eat these plants, and they've certainly been known to die from that.
My guests on today's Underreported are Jim Castle, professor of geology, and John Rogers, director of ecotoxicology of the ecotoxicology program at Clemson University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned that they deplete oxygen supplies, and that creates dead zones in the oceans, Jim?
Yes, as these algal blooms take place, high organic productivity on the surface of the water. And then over time, as the algae die, they will sink to the bottom, producing this mass of organic material. And then in the decay process, that consumes oxygen out of the water, takes it away from the available oxygen that the animals need. So that can cause, and has been proposed as a cause for mass extinctions in the past. Of course, that's also evidence that there were increased algal blooms and productivity at these times of mass extinctions as well. And we propose that it's these blooms that produce the toxins that actually kill large numbers of animals.
Do they pose a threat to coral reefs?
Well, coral reefs, of course, they're in shallow water, and there are types of algae that do pose a very real and serious risk to coral reefs. John might be able to comment on those.
As a matter of fact, in off the coast of Florida, there are clouds of dust and algae that come from Africa, and they've tracked those using modern satellites and tracked the dust to Florida. That little bit of dust provides just enough nutrients and just enough cyst of algae to promote algal growth and toxin production, and that has definitely damaged the coral.
Why, John, do algae produce toxins? Is it to deter predators?
That is a wonderful question. There are algae that produce toxins for some apparently fairly simple reasons. In other words, there are algae that actually require a blood meal as part of their activity. They're almost like vampire algae, which are appropriate this time of year. But they produce a toxin that attacks fish gills, and then they have a hemolysin or a compound that can degrade red blood cells, and they feed on that. There are all sorts of hypotheses about why algae produce these toxins, and I think that's good fodder for scientists for the rest, certainly for many careers, because we've not been able to pin down the why or the triggers necessarily.
Don't cyanobacteria also live in the roots of terrestrial plants?
Well, yes, they do.
So does that mean that when we eat something, a vegetable that comes from that plant, that we're ingesting some of those toxins?
Well, you probably wouldn't eat some of the plants that do accumulate the cyanobacteria. Some of the cyanobacteria are, for example, cycads. Some of the oldest plants on the planet seem to accumulate toxin produced in cyanobacteria. And that's actually the plant that I was referring to that is eaten by bats and other animals on some islands in the Far East. And then consequently, people eat those animals and they die.
Can some of the toxins also be aerosolized? Aren't some beaches in Texas starting to post warnings for algal blooms? Jim?
Yeah, that's right. Those toxins can move from algal blooms into the air and then be picked up and breathed by a wide range of organisms, including humans. And this has been documented and may be a contributing factor to certain mammals or reptiles that became extinct in the past.
Now, we're only talking about some species of algae, aren't we?
That's correct. There are only a few hundred species of algae out of the hundreds of thousands of species of algae that produce toxins. So we're only talking about a few hundred species of known toxin producers. Part of the concern that's emerged from this recent meeting that we've had is the notion that maybe there are more toxin producers than we thought as our analytical techniques become better. And as we develop standards, and as we standards being chemical analytical standards, as well as we know what to look for, because scientists have only been fairly recently tuned in to the widespread nature of these organisms and their ability to produce toxins.
The one most of us are familiar with are red tides.
That's correct. And those have been the most dramatic. Those are primarily marine. But now we're seeing some of those formerly marine organisms or organisms that we thought were obligate or are tied to marine systems. We're now seeing some of those move inland to our inland waters.
John, you wrote in the paper that cyanobacteria have the longest well-defined fossil life of all major organism types. What's the secret to their success over the eons?
Well, I think this toxin production is probably part of it. And if I may say, perhaps their simple lifestyle. They're fairly straightforward organisms with very wide tolerances of things in their environment. They grow lots of places. They have the ability to tolerate pretty wide conditions, but they flourish during disruptions, during climate change, and during times of change. And so that's perhaps contributed to their longevity.
Aren't they, these massive algae blooms, also one of the sources of oil and gas deposits all over the world?
Jim can probably answer better than I.
You're the geologist.
Yes, that's very true, that these algal beds are very rich source rocks for oil. They're lake beds, marine beds, and the algae provide the right kind of organic material so that when heated up, oil is produced from them.
Now, what kinds of environmental factors can cause an algal bloom? Are we humans contributing to the current situation?
That's currently one of the hypotheses, and there are certainly factors that we promote that can encourage algal blooms, but that belies the fact that algal blooms have been occurring for millions and millions of years, perhaps before people even walked the earth, and certainly well before people walked the earth. So although we can certainly aid in production of algae, we can do what we call cultural things, like use excessive fertilizers and so on. We can certainly aid in production of algae. It's unlikely that we can totally prevent these algal blooms, since they've been going on for essentially millions of years.
Scientists are also finding that parts of the northwestern Pacific Ocean are acidifying due to absorption of excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Does all that extra CO2 help fuel algal blooms?
Well, it certainly could.
We're seeing a large algae bloom off the coast of Washington and Oregon right now, aren't we?
Yes, it certainly could contribute to algal blooms. The increase in CO2 is going to increase the CO2 concentration in surface waters, and that's one of the raw materials that tend to drive algal blooms.
And I understand now we're starting to see some of this in freshwater. I always thought that that the algae only thrived in saltwater.
Well, this freshwater situation is really caught our attention because certainly less than 1% of all the water on the planet is freshwater. And when these algal blooms obviate the use of that freshwater, in other words, they get in the way of us using water as a drinking water resource, our water resource managers have to be attuned to these issues, and they have to be prepared to shift to alternative sources, and or they've got to be prepared to intercede and to intervene.
Aren't New York State waterways becoming infected with something called rock snot?
well, yes.
Is that a form of algal bloom?
Well, that is actually it's a Didymos sphenia. It's a diatom that we formerly thought came from New Zealand, but there's some thought that it was perhaps in North America for quite a while, and it is an alga that doesn't obey the rules. It is not encouraged by nutrients. It grows in cold water and prefers clean water. So it's not one of those that obeys the rule, but it's pretty devastating to a body of water.
There was a huge algal bloom off the Chinese coast around the time of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Do we know what caused that?
Actually, that bloom was attributed to the agricultural activities in that particular watershed. There were quite intensive agricultural activities in the watershed trying to prepare food in a fairly food-limited environment for lots of visitors, and as they stepped up activity, that seemed to coincide with the algal bloom. That may be one of those coincidental things. These are not controlled experiments. It's hard to say absolutely that that was the cause.
What impact has all of this been having on seabirds?
Well, there are certainly some of the seabirds that have gone extinct. There are certainly some extinctions of seabirds due to these algal blooms.
We have a listener, Tony, in San Jose, who asks, how do you know that it's not the other way around? Maybe mass extinction removes the competition and allows the algae to grow.
And that's been a theory suggested. Of course, our theory is a little bit different. Did the grazers on the algae at the time of extinctions go extinct and then the algae proliferate? Now, we don't think that because we're basing our hypothesis on what we see today, what's been observed, and that is that these algae produce toxins that then kill the grazers.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we don't eat shellfish during a red tide.
Right.
Now, one other thing, don't the algae release methane as they decay? And that's a greenhouse gas, isn't it?
Well, they certainly could under some conditions, under anoxic conditions, they could release some methane and could contribute to greenhouse gas, thereby exacerbating the ongoing warming.
Well, I'm not sure that we're facing another mass extinction as a result of this, but it looks like there's a growth of algal blooms right now. Do you think there's an ecological tipping point where they can create a mass extinction? And where would you think that is? And will I be around to witness it?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, we look at the present, make observations about today and what's going on, and that causes a lot of concern. We extrapolate back to the past and see that there were mass extinctions, and then we try to predict. It's a concern because the climate is warming. Of course, we don't know quite how fast it's going to warm, and we don't know the effects. That's hard to predict, but we need to monitor the situation, be aware of this situation so that we can
be prepared to take any actions to prevent another mass extinction.
We've been talking on today's Underreported about possible links between algae and mass extinctions with Jim Castle, professor of geology, and John Rogers, the director of the ecotoxicology program at Clemson University. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leonard.